Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Putting Points on the Board. I'm your host for the evening, Big John, here with his trusty sidekick. I'm not going to make a joke at his expense. Okay, it's Speedy Gonzalez with you. No, I'm just kidding. Andre. I'm just kidding. Send hate mail my way. That's okay. No, of course, I am talking about the co-host of the show, fantasy pioneer and legend, Mr. William Del Pilar.
Thank you there, Mr. Big John. And yep. Andale, because we've got an exciting show tonight.
I think we do, and we've got chock full of breaking news that we're going to talk about in the episode. Among them, the end of the MLB lockout, probably, right? And also, there's been a big trade in the NFL. William and I are going to touch on some humor and some other pop culture topics. But for right now, we're very excited to have someone as a guest who I've known for maybe 20 years. He's one of the original writers of sportsgrumblings.com, currently at Baseball Prospectus, a good friend of ours. And I'm going to bring him right on because I want him to be able to join us and talk about the end of the lockout and what was at play there, who's the winner, who's the loser there. So let's bring on Mr. Tim McCullough. Tim.
Andale, Tim, andale.
Good evening, my friends. How are you?
There you go. There's Mr. Tim McCullough. And first of all, Tim, we were talking off camera for a second. Let me just say something. You look marvelous, darling.
Oh, thank you marvelous. Very much. Marvelous. I appreciate that very much.
Man, I like the man cave look there with the hangings and the posters and the memorabilia looks like.
Yeah, I kind of got the music and baseball thing going on back there.
Right. Now, you know, you didn't know Tim back in the day, but let me tell you something. Tim has done an amazing job. Tim, give yourself a pat on the back. You've dropped a ton of weight, haven't you?
123 pounds.
123 pounds, wow. William. Wow. I see. I thought I was doing well, but Tim has outclassed me as he usually does, and by dropping that much weight, he looks fantastic. I'm so happy for him. I'm glad he's looking good. So Tim,
you look spectacular. I mean, John dropped 70 pounds. I heard, but I think it was all in his head.
Yeah, mostly.
He does look good though. You do look good, John.
Oh, thanks, Tim. Okay, we're done patting each other's back. Let's talk baseball right now. Tim, okay. For those that don't know, Tim is a baseball expert, recognized as such. As a matter of fact, for the three-year period of 2017 to 2019, he was the top-ranked baseball ranker. I said ranked twice, but he was the top of the game, folks, as rated by Fantasy Pros. And if you've never been to fantasypros.com, they kind of collect all the expert opinions and let you know which experts are really experts. It's not hype. They actually track the projections and see who come in on time. For a three-year period, number one, Mr. Tim McCullough, something to be proud of. And, of course, he works over at Baseball Prospectus, one of the top sites for baseball ranking and analysis. So we're really fortunate to have him on board. And, Tim, let's go right into it. What was this lockout about? It's not a strike. It's not a strike, right? Let's be clear. It was a lockout.
It was definitely a lockout. The owners could have ended it at any time. This was about the owners maintaining what they had. Mm. They were not willing to give up any of the gains that they've made over the last, I don't know, three or four collective bargaining agreements. You know, the players, I'm firmly on the players' side here. There's no question about that. But they didn't do this right. They should have started their campaign for what they wanted to negotiate. They should have started it a year or two ago and started working on it back then. Instead, they waited until the owners locked out and then decided that they wanted to fight for, you know, a quicker year to free agency or more money for the young players or more cap space up at the top so that the the top players can get paid more. I mean, they waited until the 11th hour to do that. And then by then, the owners had all the power.
Yeah. Hey, Tim, real quick, explain to the audience what a lockout is versus a strike. Because we are politics and sports, and some of our listeners may not quite may get it mixed up.
Okay. Well, a strike is generally the side of labor. So it's the laborers who go out. They refuse to work. A lockout, it's the owners. It's the team owners who lock the players out and don't allow them to come to work. The difference is, I mean, I suppose you could say that the laborers could go back to work, but they wouldn't unless they got what they wanted. And I guess that's the case here with the owners now. They finally got what they wanted. They wanted the players to cave, and essentially the players did. They caved on most of the stuff that they wanted. And it came to the point where they wanted to get back to work.
So, Tim, from your perspective, I know you know, you're a baseball guy. You've got your thumb on the pulse. Did you get the sense that baseball fans were misdirecting any anger they may had? So were they, do you think, perhaps directing anger more at players or equally at players and owners? Or what was your read on that? How are the fans reacting? Who did they actually hold accountable for, whether it was a lockout or a strike, the specter of no baseball in 2022?
I think actually, traditionally, the fans have fallen on the side of the owners. You know, they call it the billionaires versus the millionaires, and, you know, the millionaires are a bunch of whiny guys who get to play baseball and make a ton of money. But I think this time around, I wouldn't say that they fell on the side of the owners, but I think it was much more balanced. I think you had a lot more people who recognized that the players were getting screwed here, and that it was the owners that were doing the screwing. But I still don't see it falling totally towards the player's side. It just has not gone that way. I would say it was a little bit more balanced this time.
You know, Tim, not to push back, because this is your domain, and I'm coming at it more from a fan. We did baseball at KFFL more. It was more – for me, my passion was football, so I kind of kept my hand out, brought in the people like yourselves who knew it. But I always got the impression, going back to the 90s, that the fans were always behind the players. That's how I always felt it. But maybe because, in a way, I kind of sided with the owner slightly. But I know this go round, because John will tell you, I track the media, and my opinions have really changed. Yeah. It was pretty much 9-1 in terms of the – not talking about the fans, but the articles were on the side of the players. It was about a 9-1 in terms of what I read. And I'm not
I think in the media – I think you're right. I think the media got it right this time for a change. You know, in the past, the owners have really locked up the media for themselves. And, you know, they do a great job. They actually do a really good job of planting the stories where they need to plant them and getting the guys that generally write in their favor to write in their favor. This time around, there were a lot more journalists who were willing to speak out on the players' behalf. So I would say the media got it right
for a change. Were a little too slow in moving with their demands. Why is that?
They needed to get out in front of this. And I think part of that is getting both the media and the fans on their side. They needed to make it clear that it was the owners who were going to drive this lockout, and they were going to control the narrative. And I think they needed to get out in front of it.
Would you have said that maybe from just from a pure negotiating position, maybe they should have called a strike right before, say, the playoffs started or something? Or do you feel that would have been too cutthroat?
I think then they would have had fans against them.
Exactly.
It would have strengthened their position, though, right?
No. It would have, but I think that there were ways that they could have strengthened their position without going on strike.
Gotcha. Okay.
Just by doing what the owners do so well, plant those stories in the media, get people talking about the, get people talking about the players' side.
Right.
I mean, look what happened with minor league players over this past year. you know, finally now, finally, after all these years, the owners are going to pay for housing for minor league players.
Right.
And that's because it was reported in the media, and that's where it got started. And I think, you know, if the players are going to win this thing or win anything back, they need to start well ahead of the actual talks.
But it is a very delicate balance, right? Because most fans will, like as you said in the past, for example, would say, well, what are these millionaires complaining about, right? So they want to raise the league minimum to something that's 10 times the average American salary, you know, for sitting on the bench playing a game. So I think that's always that fine balance. You've said they should have gotten out ahead of it. What specifically do you think should have been the narrative that the players put out there to really drive home the point of why they felt the owners were being unfair?
Two key points. One would be for the young players. I mean, that was one of the things that they made clear or were trying to make clear throughout these talks, was that they were fighting for the young players. Now, the average major league career is 3 years.
Hmm.
And you have to play for six just to become a free agent.
Right.
So the system is rigged against you to start with. So if the average major league career is 3 years, you get 3 years to make your decent money.
Right.
Because you don't make it in the minor leagues, that's for sure.
Oh, that's, yeah, you're right.
So you have basically 3 years of earning power. Except for the big stars.
Right, right. I have a question on that. So when somebody, say, a no-name player, just your working-class grunt player makes it to the big leagues. So when I was studying up for this, they were earn a minimum of about $500,000 a year, correct? And that's going to move up to about $700,000. So they got 3 years. Okay, I want to clarify that for the audience. And I think that's one reason why the players have to be delicate about this, because of what you're saying, John. The average salary is, what, $30,000 for the average person? One comment I want to make to both of you guys as a PR guy, there's no way anybody would have told the players strike before the playoffs, because the fans would have looked at the players as being – that's – it's kind of like that. That's kind of slicing your own throat.
From a PR perspective, William, I agree with you. It would have been disaster from a PR. But I'm talking about securing a CBA, and memories are notoriously short in the public.
No, they're not. It took years for a lot of fans to come back after the 90s strike. What was it, 94 or 93, right around that?
94.
Yeah, 94. Yeah, no. That's my point. They're fighting for the cap, so the players are in a tough position because of the numbers we're talking, the billionaires versus millionaires. So they have to do this a certain way to be able to get what they want and keep the fans. And you keep the fans on your side. Every day there's less baseball, the more the people are going to hate the owners, because they feel, well, the owners have the purse strings. They're already billionaires.
Right.
So the players have to play that. But when you take the game away and it's right before the playoffs and it's because of the players, oh, that's like your own throat.
Right.
Obviously, William, you wouldn't have been welcome in Jimmy Hoffa's circles.
I'd be buried alongside him. And I have my dream of finally playing on the football field, huh? Giant Stadium. I'm sorry, Tim. Go ahead.
Tim, in your mind, you went over, you're pretty much think the owners came out ahead on this. Can you break down where the big victory was for the owners? Did the players get anything from what you could tell?
They get some things. I mean, they did raise the – I was looking for the exact numbers. They did raise the competitive balance tax from $230 million in 2022 and reach $244 million by 2026. That is a victory for the owners. And the reason is – it does not keep pace with the growth of revenue in the game.
So before you go any further, explain that. What's a competitive tax, and like someone will say, well, is that like a cap number? What is that? Is that what,
it basically functions, it effectively functions as a salary cap because teams that go over that amount pay a penalty. They pay a tax.
So it's
that
like
gets
the, so it's
distributed
like
the, to the other 29 teams.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's like the luxury tax in the NBA.
It's similar. It's right. similar to that, yeah.
But in essence, a team does not want to surpass that in terms of for 10 zillion reasons, both ethical and unethical.
Right.
You know?
And, well, right. And the sad part is that there are only a handful of teams that even approach the tax.
Wow. There
are 14 of the 30 teams actually spend less than they take in just television revenue every year.
Right, right.
That's without ever selling a ticket.
So now on that point, Tim, the other end of the spectrum is the players were asking for some sort of minimum spend to be in place for two reasons. One, to make sure that every team pays players a little more, almost, you know, being forced to open up their pockets, dig into their pockets. But then the other reason would be to sort of prevent tanking by getting rid of superstar players and bringing in nothing but rookies and prospects, you know, something like, well, who is it that does that all the time? The Rays and the Marlins, right?
The Rays and the Orioles.
And the Orioles are famous for that. What did you feel about
Pirates.
That? What did you feel about that?
Well, actually, it's funny. The idea of a floor was something that Rob Manfred brought up a floor. He wanted a, I think it was a $100 million floor he offered, but only if they lowered the ceiling also. So, you know, you wanted to squeeze it. And again, it would have functioned more as a salary cap than anything else. I think a floor is a great idea, or I think at least teams should make a commitment to spend at least a certain amount every year. It's ridiculous that teams, you know, there are so many teams that have payrolls now down in the $50 and $60 million range. Yeah, you know, they make over $100 billion a year just in television revenue.
Right. And guys, as a PR guy or a former PR guy, not officially, I just want to add some of the entrepreneurial things. I was PR guy. That's one of the aspects that the union should have pushed. Look at these billionaires; they don't even want to spend. Because I got to be honest, this is the first time I've actually delved into the weeds, you know, of the deal. And my thought process is, oh my God, in my mind, it was always a small market team. They just can't compete with the Yankees. But then I'm reading about the Orioles and I'm like, they're not even trying to compete. And as a fan, I find that offensive, especially considering what they charge me for a damn ticket and a hot dog. And they're not fielding a competitive team.
And they're going to make it even worse now by expanding the playoffs.
Right.
Now we're going to have 12 teams in the playoffs.
Right.
So now teams are even more disincentivized to spend money. Why should I spend money on payroll? I probably am going to make the playoffs just by going, you know, 500, playing 500
with lesser
balls.
Players. With lesser players and a lesser payroll, they have a better shot now of making the playoffs, so they don't have to spend. In football, we have the Cincinnati Bengals who did that for years.
Yeah.
But that's one team. In baseball, it's like a whole bunch of teams, it seems like.
But you know what's interesting? So, Tim, I'll throw this in because, as William always likes to point out, I'm the libertarian on the show.
I identify as libertarian as well, John.
Oh, God bless you, Tim. But
God bless you, libertarians.
It's the reason why we've always gotten along.
Exactly. But here's what I'm thinking, Tim and William. The reason teams chintz out, or some teams chintz out, is because the fans keep coming back. Right? If you view it as a business, they're there to make money. The Bengals were there to make money. The Orioles, look, if the Orioles can still get that TV revenue, Tim said it's $100 million. Their payroll is like $42 million, I read.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, without a single fan ever buying a ticket, their ROI is over 100%. Yep.
Right, but I think they're being short-sighted, and maybe Timmy had more insight because it may have changed. But for a while, the demographics were where they were aging out, they were dying. The blue hairs were the demographic, and the ratings were slowly dropping. But then maybe 5 years ago, it started to reverse. But even then, I still think it's short-sighted because we're becoming a fragmented society. And right now, all these streaming services are going to pay monster numbers to make that impact. But eventually, after we're gone in 15, 20 years, they're going to revert back to it's a slow sport compared to the newer sports, the football, et cetera.
Right.
So,
absolutely. You know, back in 94, we didn't have streaming services. In fact, we barely had the internet, right?
Right.
So, so of course, fans came back. You know, it was a major source of entertainment. Nowadays, they've got dozens and dozens of choices that they didn't have back then. And that's why it has nothing to do with aging out it really doesn't, I don't think. I don't think age has anything to do with it. It's a timeless game in that way. But everybody has more choices, many more entertainment choices now than they had back then. Mm-hmm. Why would I pay, you know, ridiculous price to go sit in a ballpark for 3.5 or 4 hours to watch a ball game when for, you know, pennies on the dollar, I can go somewhere else and be entertained just as nicely.
Right. And on top of that, when I go to a football game, if it's a blowout, I'm out of there. You know, when you got 70,000 people in a stadium. But for baseball, whether it's a blowout or not, by the seventh inning, I'm like, should I sit there and stick around or not? And then when the 182 or 160 some odd games, it kind of makes that decision. So I completely agree with you, Tim. Our choices and our attention span, for that matter, are completely changing.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely true. And it's interesting to me. Like, I'll be honest with you. My love of baseball diminished greatly after the strike, not in 94, but what was it, 87, Tim? 87. I used to have season tickets to the Mets. I gave them up in protest. I said, okay. And to be honest with you, I haven't set foot at a baseball game since then. Yeah. I'm almost entirely focused on the NFL. And they lost me as a really ardent fan. I mean, I played baseball in high school. You know, it was a love of mine. Tom Seaver and Rusty Staub, my two favorite players growing up. And, you know, you couldn't keep me away from a Mets game when I was younger. Even in college, I would cut school to go watch the Mets.
Yeah.
So I understand William's point of PR, you know, like to get the fans back. But at the same time, I'm sitting looking at an owner saying, like, whoever owns the Orioles, I don't know who the owners are of the Orioles. But
the Angelos, Peter Angelos.
Oh, okay. Why in God's name would a businessman, not a baseball fan, a businessman say, I have a guaranteed doubling of my revenue, of my, you know, I'm making 100% of what I put into a business, which is fantastic. Any CEO will tell you 100% ROI is, you dream of that, right?
Right.
Why would he give that up? If he doesn't have to lift a finger, why would he give that up? Now, I understand William's point that if enough teams behave that way, the game itself will wither and die. And that's a real danger.
Yeah,
that's an economic issue you're talking, John. And
no, absolutely, it's not a passion issue that I'm talking about. I'm framing it as an economic issue. So to me, that's something that's always going to be a battle because there are going to be owners, unless you have a strong commissioner that is willing to stand up, not give lip service to, but actually stand up for the integrity of the game. You're going to have this. Like, why would they do it? I there's no economic incentive to do it. Like in the NFL. Right? Everything is shared, and, you know, they've worked out a system where if one team is dragging its behind, they all suffer.
Well, here's one reason, John, and maybe Tim has the insight. The Orioles actually changed the landscape of sports stadiums. They were the first one to go in and revitalize an area of Baltimore that was decrepit. That was it was like Batman and his parents walking in the alleyway. You're going to get mugged. So the one reason fans came because it became an all day event. Do the shopping, hit a bar afterwards. So in the Orioles' mind, the fans were going to come back regardless. So why spend money? Now I'm not saying I'm right, but based off the baseball owners and their system. it didn't behoove them to put much. Plus, Cal Ripken at the time was drawing people alone. People were saying, hey, where this guy's getting old, and I want to go see a superstar. And with the Padres, it was different because I don't know if Tony Gwynn was playing, but Tony Gwynn would drive people to the stands. The, well, we got to see Tony Gwynn, one of the greatest hitters. So maybe baseball, I'm speculating, and Tim, this is your sport there. Maybe you have insight, but as somebody who deals with economics at times, I kind of see that in a way.
Yeah, for the owners, it's no longer about the game anymore. It's about the investment. I mean, if you think about the history of the game, and I don't want to go too long here, but traditionally these teams were owned by families that passed them down, right? That passed them down to the next in line. Now they're owned by corporations. I mean, there's still some families involved, but they're in it for the investment now. They're not in it for the game. They're not in it for the fans. They couldn't care less about the fans.
But, Tim, to be fair, what is the legal fiduciary duty of a corporation?
Well, true. Make money for shareholders.
Maximize profit for shareholders. That's their one legal obligation. So, yep. So
well,
I get it.
For the families, it was that. But whenever the owner would die,
right.
These taxes, and that's why most families would have to sell their teams. They wanted to win, but they would also pay top dollar. But you also got to remember, once the 70s hit, the dollar has changed the value and how much they pay, et cetera, et cetera. A good analogy for the baseball fan is Las Vegas. Back in the early 90s, before it fully went corporate, y'all remember it because y'all are old enough, for $9.99, you get steak, lobster, eggs, the whole meal. Now that $9.99 doesn't even get you a 1 hour pass into the parking lot because of corporations. So you're right. It's their job is to make a profit, but they're also destroying various aspects of America in terms of apple pie and all that because they're making things unaffordable. You go to a lot of games. I have not gone to a game. What John was saying about 87, baseball lost me in 94. I have gone to plenty of games since then, but I've never gone for myself. It's because somebody's given me a ticket or friends in town. There's an event with a group. I have never gone, I'm going to go to this game because I want to.
Same here. I love the game. I write about the game on a regular basis, and I have for over 20 years now. I can't remember the last time I went to a ball game.
What is this international – if you can explain to the fans, because we get a lot of import players. As a Latino, I love Major League Baseball because they help a lot of Latinos get out of poverty because those contracts are guaranteed versus other sports. But what is the international draft, and where does that stand in terms of this new deal?
Well, right now there is no international draft, right? Players – teams can sign – they have a signing period where they can sign these – international players during this particular period of time, and there's a pool of money. I mean, I don't know enough about it to really be an expert, but there's a pool of money upon which they have to draw in order to sign these players, and they can't go over the pool amount. The problem with the whole international system is that it's rife with corruption. Okay. Now you've got teams that are going in and courting players at the age of 12, signing them at the age of 16, and doing so for peanuts. And once again, bringing them for peanuts to the United States, where they don't know the language and they don't know the culture and they're thrust into an unfamiliar situation.
And they're all poor, right, Tim? They're dirt poor. So, Even what we consider peanuts to them is like they might as well be kings at that point. Like when you look at some of these poor kids from the Dominican Republic or from Mexico perhaps, or maybe not the Japanese players they import, but
Japanese is a whole different story.
Yeah, it's a different story, but I'm talking specifically about like the Latinos especially, right?
Yeah.
From the islands and everything. So
from the islands in Venezuela.
Oh, yeah.
Panama.
Yeah.
There's a couple of Panamanian players there, and Tim, that's one thing, I'm very political, and one thing I get aggravated at America, I was like, y'all talk poor, y'all don't know poor. Go to a third world country. So that's something I get very harsh about because I'm like, there's no struggle here when you compare it to the rest of the world. I
mean, there is a struggle. Fun fact, our poverty line in most of the world is considered that country's top 5%.
That's scary.
Right? Yeah, our what we consider our poverty line, which is what, 17,000, 18,000 a year, in most of the world is considered a top 5%, you know? And I'm not talking about developed countries like in Europe, but I'm talking if you go to these poor islands to say some places, not everywhere, of course, South America, in the African continent, and places like that. Yeah. Our poverty line is wealthy in those countries. So imagine you're a poor kid living meal to meal, basically. Your parents probably work in a factory if they work at all. And here comes Mr. American wearing a big straw hat, chomping on a cigar, and because you could steal second fairly easily.
And it's not just that. It's what America represents.
Sure.
So they welcome the red carpet out. I mean, when I go back to visit, they no longer see me as a Panamanian. My relatives, they're all protective of me because I'm now the Yankee in Panama.
Do they call you a gringo?
No, they do make fun of my accent. They're like, shut up. Don't say a word. They're going to recognize you're a Yankee, and they're going to try to mug us.
Yeah. All right, Tim, I want to move on a little bit. Given that the strike, let's put it this way: has it been officially accepted by the players' union?
I don't think the players have ratified yet. The owners have ratified.
Right, and I think the player representatives and the subcommittee, which is a total of 38 guys, I think they approved it or they recommended it to be ratified by the membership. So
I believe so, yes.
So technically it hasn't been accepted yet, but let's, for the purposes of discussion, assume it has been. They're talking about the first week of April of being opening day. The missed games, which I think were the first two series of the season, they're saying those are not canceled. They're going to be made up. I haven't heard if they're going to – have you heard, are they going to expand the season or are they just planning on fewer off days or more doubleheaders or something to make up the games?
I believe it's going to end up being doubleheaders. Probably. It was only a few series.
It was two series. Yeah, so maybe six games so far were postponed, as it turns out.
Yeah. It'll end up being more than that because of the time that's transpired since. So they'll have more to make up than just two series, but it won't be more than, say, four series.
Okay. Do you think that the players just functionally have enough time to get into shape? I mean, they've had no spring training, right? And if the April timeline holds true, that's like 3 weeks away, right? So is that enough time, you think?
No. I think we've already seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are players risking injury?
Even in 2020, right, when they knew they were going to play at some point, right, they knew they were going to play. They could have been out there working out, and we still ended up not only with a boatload of injuries in 2020, a 60-game season, but the following year. I mean, last year was a nightmare.
Oh, especially for pitchers, right?
If you played fantasy baseball last year, it was a nightmare. Just to fill your lineup out. It was tough. It was really tough. And we're going to have it again this year.
You broached the subject, so I'm going to bring it up. Fantasy baseball, all right?
Okay.
Some of our viewers and listeners are going to be interested in that. Who are Tim McCullough's, say, top players to keep an eye on for the upcoming season?
Top players to keep an eye on. Okay. Well, there's too many to list. But Kyle Tucker would be one right off the bat. Outfielder for the Houston Astros, had a big breakout year last year, but I think he's got another gear. I mean, he put up some huge numbers. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I can do that, though, if you like. He had a huge season last year, and I think we're going to see him take another step forward. Kyle Tucker is one. Another one would be – let's see. Matt Chapman. Okay. First of all, I don't think he's going to end up in Oakland. I think he's going to end up being traded at some point. But I really like Matt Chapman a great deal. I think he's going to have a big season. And teammate Matt Olson, he had a big breakout year last year. I think he's got another gear.
Last year. I made some DFS money off of Olson last year on occasion. So, yeah, you think he's going to build on last season?
I think he's going to build on it. And actually, Chapman signed with New York. Didn't Chapman sign with New York?
Chapman, I just had him up. New York Yankees.
No, I think he signed with the Mets. No.
Oh, it says here, NYY. So,
all right, he's going to end up in New York.
No. Wrong Chapman. I did this with Art Schliester the other night. I said it was a different Schliester.
He told us Art Schliester had died, so
we had to
correct that. But anybody
well,
else?
Well, they have him listed with Oakland still.
Yeah, he's still listed with Oakland,
but he's with New York now. Right. I think he's going to do great in New York. He's going to do great in City Field.
Are there any rookies you've got your eye on?
I gotta be honest with you. I'm not a rookie guy. I pass on rookies. I played in redraft leagues.
Okay.
I'm in one dynasty league. And I guess the guy that I really like there is Wander Franco. Now he's not a rookie.
Right.
But he had a huge debut last year.
Yes.
And he's another guy I really love to take another step forward. I don't think we're going to see him run a ton. Just because the Rays don't really play that game, they don't run a lot. So I don't think we're going to see Wander Franco run much. But he drove
in. I'll be honest, Tim. When I look at the young rookies, I don't want to say they're rookies, but I usually look for the call-ups towards the middle end of the season, you know?
When the players
are already tired, grinding, you get a fresh pair of legs. I remember I kicked some serious tail grabbing, I want to say, Ian Kinsler when I had KFFL and I was playing competitively one year when he was with the, I want to say, the Blue Jays. But I always look at the youngsters at that point in time because, like you, early on, I'm like, we don't know what we're going to get long-term.
Yeah, I do have a rookie for you though, Tristan Casas. Have you heard of Tristan Casas?
Tell us about him.
He's a first baseman. He's currently playing for the AAA Woo Sox for the Red Sox. You know, he's in their organization. He plays first base. Last year, he surprised in Double A. All of a sudden, he had a hit for power. He's always been a great spray hitter, one of these doubles kind of guys.
Right.
Last year, all of a sudden, he was hitting for power like crazy, playing up in Portland. This year, he's starting off in Worcester at the Woo Sox. But keep in mind who the Red Sox have at first base. That's his name. I'm drawing a blank now. Yeah, keep in mind. Have a brain.
Hey, Tim, a couple of players that you think that are going to be drafted high but are going to come back to earth. I don't want to say necessarily bust, but, you know, that people are maybe overvaluing.
Oh, boy. Just about every closer in the game.
Oh, wow.
They're all being overvalued like crazy. Bobby Dalbec is the Red Sox first baseman. And he had great second half. He had a really good August, let's put it that way, and part of September. But aside from that, all he did was stink up the joint like crazy. And I think this guy, Casas, has a chance to displace him like that.
Go. Let me see if I could do this in my best accent from Beantown. Hold on. Go Sox!
Not bad.
Tim.
Not bad.
I know you're a transplanted New Yorker living up in Boston now, or Boston area, right? So did I suppress my law? Could I pass for Go Sox?
Not quite. You're not quite there, Joe.
I'm not quite there yet. Okay. So
stick with your New York.
New Yorker. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Tim, let me ask you this. We talked some lockout. We talked some of your fantasy players. Let's reminisce a little bit. Tell me about your sports grumblings days, folks. Listen, let me tell you something. When we were running sports grumblings back in the day, Tim was my main man. He started out as a writer, but by the time we were done, until he left for other opportunities, he basically was my editor-in-chief. He handled all the sports, even though he himself is a diehard baseball fan. He was handling all four content for all four sports. One of the I can't emphasize enough how much I love Tim as a person. But when we were grinding it out with Sports Grumblings, he was my main guy when it came to content and staying on schedule while I was doing all the nutty stuff that the owner has to do. Tim was the dependable guy, and aside from that, like I said, just a great guy overall. Tim,
You're much too kind, John.
I'm not being kind enough, sir. But give us some war stories, some original SG war stories.
Original SG war stories.
For the rebirthing of the brand.
You want to know something, though?
What's
up? I'll tell you what I remember most about Sports Grumblings, okay? When I joined you, John, I was in the fantasy sports business all of about 10 minutes. I had been writing for a couple of sites. There was a guy back then named Dr. Stats who was kind of nuts, but he was a great guy. But, you were the guy that taught me the business. So, yeah, maybe I was handling the editing and maybe I was the reliable guy. But you taught me what I know. You're the guy who taught me about the business itself. And without what I learned from Sports Grumblings, I definitely would not be where I am today. So that's what I remember most about Sports Grumblings.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And the love goes both ways here. I was telling William, I said, Tim, you got to meet him. You'd fall in love with the guy. He's one of the good ones. And we've said that in this industry, William and I have talked about this on the podcast, this industry is notoriously cutthroat. And it's notoriously every man for himself, right? And every woman for herself, right?
Yep.
I know you have a wonderful story. I've related it, so I'll let you tell it.
Okay.
And if we have to, we'll clean it up, but don't worry about it.
Okay.
I'll try to keep you on the straight and narrow legally, but go ahead. Tell us your story that everyone
can
still love.
I can keep it clean.
There you go.
That's for sure. You have to remind me, though, what was the name of the guy who was doing the posting, was publishing the articles when I first joined you? What was his name?
Was it Tony Finn?
Tony Finn.
Right.
Okay.
Another person in the past.
So this starts with Tony Finn.
Okay.
So we were talking about, he and I were talking about, what should we put up on the site? It was right at the beginning. I don't remember if it was the beginning of football season or the beginning of baseball season, but it was, we were coming up on a season. He said to me, we don't really have like a draft advice article. We don't have any kind of a draft advice article. I'm like, okay, I'll do a draft advice article. I said, but you got to be careful with draft advice articles because a lot of the stuff that I read on the internet, and of course there was a limited amount of stuff that back then. So a lot of the stuff is very similar. So you go from one site to the next, and it's you're getting the same advice in different places. And I said, and definitely if I write an article for you to post on Sports Grumblings, do not call it the Draft Day Manifesto. Do not do that. I specifically said that to Tony. So I go home and I write and I have to be honest, when I first learned how to play fantasy sports, a lot of what I learned on an old site called The Talented Mr. Roto.
For our fans out there, I'll just jump in here. Talented Mr. Roto was the launching pad for Matthew Berry on the ESPN fantasy guru at this point, right?
Yeah, I don't think he still uses that moniker at all, but.
No, but, yeah. No, okay.
Anyway, so the article that I wrote ended up, you know, it definitely had elements of talented Mr. Roto's draft day manifesto. And that was because it was the best advice I had read anywhere. But as far as, you know, reading it and then turning around and writing, that I didn't do. I worked off the top of my head. Anyway, I sent the article in to Tony, and the next morning I look on the site and there it is, Draft Day Manifesto. Draft Day Manifesto.
Yeah.
Which was the title of Matt Berry's article every right. year on Talented Mr. Roto. Now at this point, I think you should pick up the story.
Right.
Because it really is you from here on.
Well, it was funny because, you know, back in the day, we're running Sports Grumblings, and for some reason, I don't know why, I was in Boston at the time. So without knowing it, I was in your neck of the woods, and I was in a meeting with someone, and my cell phone starts ringing off the hook. And I'm like, I didn't recognize the number, so I ignored it. By the time I got to it in the break, I listened to the voicemails. There must have been a couple of voicemails from Matt Berry. And he's like, yeah, is this John? What's going on over there? You guys, what are you guys, lifting my work? What's the matter with you? Blah, 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 blah. You know, call me back before I get the lawyers involved, you know. I was like, wait, what's going on? You know, like, I was totally lost, right? So I think I called him back and I said, hey, man, what's up? You know, now Berry, of course, at this point, I'm not going to say he'll deny this. I'm going to say he doesn't even remember any of this at this point because it was almost 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But so I talked to him and I said, what's up? He goes, listen, one of your writers, this Tim McCullough, he's ripping me off, man, like word for word plagiarism. I said, whoa, wait a second. Tim? That's not the Tim I know. What's going on, man? He goes, listen, when you go through that article, and he read your article, by the way, and he objected to one word. I'm not exaggerating.
Oh,
he
wow.
said, I'm the only one who uses this word.
Manifesto.
No, it wasn't even manifesto. It was something in the article. He found one word that he claimed was, quote, his word, and that the only way any other person on the planet would have thought to have used that word in that context would have been by lifting it off of him. So I said, hey, man, no offense, but if you feel like bringing lawyers into this, please do, because this is nonsense. I've never heard of anything like this. Like, I don't, unless that word was your name, there's absolutely no grounds for this, man. And he's like, all right, you'll see, you'll see. And that was the last I heard from him. Needless
to
say.
What was the word?
I don't even remember, but I'm telling you, it was so innocuous, you know, like, it might have been the word innocuous for all I know. You know? It's like, but he just claimed it was his. And I'm not saying this to disparage Matt, right? Because, like, he felt he was being ripped off. Of course he wasn't, but it was just funny to me the way this thing played out, and it didn't lead anywhere. And Tim, the thing I have to tell you is, I told William this when I was, and I still am, on the board of directors of the Fantasy Sports Writers Association, mm-hmm. and several years ago I was on the committee that judged submissions for nominations for Writer of the Year, Article of the Year, you know, things like that. And there was one guy who submitted, and I'm not kidding you, my article on consistency, word for word.
Oh,
and the way you got those back in the day was...
I think I know who it was.
Yeah, I know who... you probably know who it is, too, but I'm not going to mention his name. But wow. So he submitted the article, and I'm not exaggerating. It was word for word lifted off the Sports Grumbling site. So I sent something to the head of the board of directors, and I said, look, I can't talk about every article. I know this one's plagiarized. I said, well, goes, John, how can you be so sure? I go, because it's literally the same thing that's on my site. And I showed him the site with the prior publication date and everything. And he goes, how do you want to handle it? I go, well, obviously I'm not going to award him anything. It's like, you know, that's my solution is I threw it in the circular file, you know.
Yeah.
But in a world where this is what I mean about cutthroat, nobody gives credit to anybody for anything.
Nope.
If there's an opportunity to plunge a knife in your back, it will most 99% of the time it'll find its way there. I always told William one of the reasons we got along is you could tell William is a man of his word. He's not going to go back on his word. He's not going to screw anyone over. I'd like to think the people that I hired, with one exception, were all good, loyal people, not looking to backstab each other. And I can't tell you how happy I was to have you on the team and to be able to grow the business with you. One of the saddest days for me as a business owner was when you left for a better opportunity. And I've never begrudged any of my writers the chance to go to a better opportunity. But I have to tell you, I felt so bad for our readers, and I felt bad that I had lost such a trusted employee. But I'm also happy that it worked out for you. I'm also extremely happy to see you healthy, and because I know you had your issues, and I know you struggled a bit, and I can't tell you how happy I am to see you in such good shape, on the mend and on the road to health. So, Tim, thank you for joining us. Please give out your Twitter handle so the folks can follow you and have access to your knowledge and your musings on baseball.
All right, it's at Tim's Tens. That's TIMSTENZ.
There you go. I don't even want to ask what the tens is for. Was that to capture the urban crowd, Tim?
Sort of, I guess. Well, whatever, you know. I had an article. I had a column.
There you go.
Tim's Tens. And right. I never got rid of the handle.
No problem. Well, Tim, it was great having you on, and we're going to have you on soon again, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Let's come back to talk some baseball in the near future, okay?
Absolutely. I'll talk to you guys anytime.
All right, Tim. It was great seeing you. Talk William, to you later.
Pleasure Thank meeting you. Jim.
Pleasure to meet you. We'll talk again. I'll tell you all my story next time.
Okay. Absolutely. All right. Bye-bye now.
See ya. All right. So that was Tim McCullough. Great guy, William. Great guy. And
Sounds
as you can
very
tell,
down to earth.
Yeah, very down to earth, very knowledgeable, and one of my favorite persons on the planet. But having talked about baseball, you know we got to move on to the next big thing, breaking news today. There was yet another trade, William. I can't remember so many big trades right before the start of the NFL, official start of the NFL season. But today we had a trade between the Bears and the Los Angeles Chargers, dare I say your Chargers, William.
Former Chargers, they're in L.A. now. Former San Diego. And I'll be honest, I'm a bad person because I'm like, I want them to lose every week now.
Oh, there you go. You're like a jilted girlfriend at this point.
Exactly, exactly. You know? It kind of pains me at how good they are right now, at least on paper. Because the thing with the Chargers is that we can always count on, at least when they were in San Diego, no matter how good they looked on paper, come the end of the season, it was a losing record or a very disappointing record.
Yeah. And the last couple of seasons, they were especially known for losing the tight games, like less than a touchdown, you know?
You and I were talking when the Raiders were playing the Chargers, and we assumed, I can't remember, who did we assume? I think it was the Chargers that was it the Chargers that were winning? And we just assumed they were going to win the game.
We assumed they were going to win, or we assumed it would be a tie, in which case both of them would have made the playoffs.
But that was after the Raiders came back.
After the Raiders came back to fourth overtime. It was unbelievable. But here's something that may help that situation, William. The Chargers traded for really one of the better defensive players when he was healthy, Khalil Mack, going from the Bears to the Chargers for what, let's get your opinion on this one, a second-round pick this year and a sixth-round pick next year. So, William, what do you make of this trade?
Well, first of all, I think when Khalil Mack is healthy, he is the predominant edge rusher. Maybe that's
amazing. Yes, amazing play. You know,
at least he was when he was traded from the Raiders to the Bears, and he hasn't lost much of a step. And he had that foot injury, I believe, last November, and that's one reason why they traded him, and why I think they accepted the second and sixth round pick because they don't have a first round pick. Now they have two second round picks, and they can maybe parlay that into grabbing somebody towards the end of the first round. But I kind of can't argue, but I would have considered, because we don't know the situation. We don't know the mental framework of right. Khalil Mack right now or the team. We don't understand the inner workings. But I wonder how much they deeply talked about holding on to him and waiting until before the trade deadline to trade him for future picks, maybe even a first rounder right. to a contender. You know, because he is the premier edge rusher. He's the thing about Khalil Mack. He's like, we always talk about Aaron Donald, but Khalil Mack is the exact same thing. He's one of the few defensive players that is a difference maker. And what makes him more unique than, say, a Deion Sanders, who was one of the last shutdown corners. Now, Deion could have tackled to save his life, but nobody could really throw on him. And the game has changed since then. So that's right. why I think Deion Sanders is one of the last ones. But what makes somebody like Khalil Mack and even, you know, Aaron Donald much more dominant than say, Deion Sanders is the fact Deion can shut down one side of the field. The problem with Khalil Mack, he can come from anywhere on that line. So you're that's constantly true. Having to shift from him. So I guess from the Bears' perspective, what they kind of like about this situation is and I want to go to my notes here because there's a bunch of numbers here. The Bears are free and clear after 2022 with the salary right. cap yeah. with him. With Mack gone, they're projected to have $120 million in salary cap in space in 2023. And they gained $6.15 million in cap space this season, $28.5 million in cap space in 2023, and $26.25 in 2024. That would have been the last year of Mack's contract. However, the downside is they have to eat $24 million in dead cap this year. But and I'll pass it on to you. Why does it even matter if they're going to eat it this year?
Right, exactly. So the point is that it sounds like the Chargers got Mack cheap. It sounds that way.
Well, they did. But well, it was a win-win still.
Right. But here's what's interesting is, to your point, I know you threw out all those numbers, which were all correct, by the way. But here's just to sum it up, that was almost $85 million that Khalil Mack was due. So that burden for a team that's rebuilding, that's too much of a burden.
Right.
So
right.
And they've announced they're rebuilding. You know, that's all there is to it. You
very
know,
so, smart thing to announce.
Absolutely. So they got Justin Fields. They paid up for Justin Fields last season. They got a new coaching staff in there, somebody who hopefully knows how to run an offense. So they needed to get back some of that draft capital, but also to your point, projected to have $120 million over the cap next season. And that includes the current contracts of like Eddie Goldman
yeah.
who and other, like there's all the one or two contracts that they're going to get rid of probably.
Right,
so that
right.
$120 million is more than likely to become $130, $140 probably, right? So
right.
they are just – they're going to wait. They're building up their cash reserves to get the key young difference-making free agents in 2023. At least that's the plan. So from that perspective, eating $24 million to free up over the course of 3 years nearly $61 million bucks, plus you get back your second. The sixth is, you know, who cares? But – The equivalent of the second.
Hold on. I do remember somebody named Brady. I think that was a sixth round pick.
Right. good luck hitting on that again. But let's face it. The major draw there was that at least now you have two picks in the second round. Those are at least something you could get some core. If you're a good drafter, you could get some core around those players. Whether it's offensive linemen or starting to build, like I would assume they'll probably get some offensive linemen to protect Fields.
Right.
Or whatever.
The agency, they're going to play around. And like you said, it's going to be young. And for the fans who don't understand, why are you trading Khalil Mack? Because when I first saw the headline, I was like, what? But they are in a rebuilding year. But the key here is that Khalil Mack is I want to say 31.
He's 31. Yeah, he's 31.
So a rebuilding year takes – about 3 years before you're playoff competitive, if everything goes right.
Two, if you do everything right, it'll still take 2 years.
At minimum,
yeah.
You
know? Yeah, yeah.
But statistically, you're looking at a little bit longer, and the chances of Khalil Mack still being the preeminent edge rusher was not likely. So they
no, figured, you're right. Yeah.
We'll clear out the salary cap.
Yep.
We'll get a few rounds. If this was poker, their hand has immensely improved come draft
yes.
day.
Yes.
So Well, on the surface, it looks like, yeah, that's all they got was the second and the sixth. On the surface, into the weeds of the NFL, the salary cap, and what they're trying to do with the rebuild, it was actually a pretty good move they made. And for the Chargers, you know, he's going to be he's a game changer on defense if he comes back. He's going to be paired with Joey Bosa.
That's the big thing, right? Like, exactly. Now you've got someone – remember, last episode we said you need two guys that could get to the quarterback. I said that. Yeah, you need two in today's game because the rules are such that, like, after that Kansas City-Buffalo game that we saw in the playoffs where there were, like, what, three touchdowns in 2 minutes scored at the end of the game, like, you need someone when – you need – on the defense, you need two guys that could come from either edge that when the situation is – a known passing down, you need those guys to get to the quarterback fast. You can't have a Patrick Mahomes. You can't have an Aaron Rodgers with any sort of time. You got to make them once.
Well, Aaron Rodgers just needs the playoffs to come back down.
Yeah, see, but you're right. If it was Aaron Rodgers, I might let him do his thing anyway because he always chokes in the playoffs anyway. But
the Rams.
Yeah.
They got Von Miller. Right before the trade deadline.
To go with Aaron Donald.
Exactly. And he had a defensive line, despite the fact the refs gave them the Super Bowl. They got to the Super Bowl.
He's going to say that again, folks. He's going to keep saying that.
I will be on my deathbed if somebody brings that Super Bowl up. I'll say,
But I will say one thing. It's one of these rare trades that I think both teams accomplished their goals.
Well, yeah, to go out with the Chargers. The Chargers got, you know, obviously they only gave up a second and sixth round.
They're taking on money.
But they can get out of Mac's deal easily. He can be cut in 2023, and it'll save him. It'll save the team $16.9 million, or in 2024, and it'll save them $20.3 million.
Right,
and
because
that's important. That means Mac has to perform.
Right.
To finish out that contract, he's got to perform.
Yeah, and to your point, the reason they could get out of it cheaply is because the guaranteed money is what's considered the dead cap money for the Bears.
Exactly.
So the Bears eat that money that they guaranteed, right? So much like the deficit in Washington, when you keep kicking the can down the road, right, when that can goes up against the wall, you've got no choice. You've got to deal with it now, and that's why we have inflation now, right? So the same thing with the Bears, right? With Khalil Mack, they said, okay, we're going to pay you a bunch of money. This is when they picked him up from the Raiders, right? We're going to pay you a bunch of money, but in order to make each individual year more manageable, we're going to guarantee your bonus over this thing, and we get to prorate it, right? But now that he's off the team, everything they owed him gets squeezed into this season. That's why you have that $24.2 or so million dollar hit in dead money.
The good thing is
now they're done now. Like, that's it. After this season, they're done. But to your point, they're in essence tanking this season in order to rebuild. So to them, it doesn't matter that they're cost this year.
And what's important about that is you rarely ever hear of a team admitting that they're in a rebuild mode. You know, and at the end of the day, by stating they're in a rebuild mode, that 6-11 was it 6-11 they were last year? I want to say, matter if they go 2-14. We're in a rebuild mode now. Yeah. On the flip side, the Chargers are on a team rising, and that's because they have one of the top young QBs in Herbert.
Yes,
you know, and now they can score points quickly. You know, Justin Herbert can put points on the board, but now they've got the Bosa and Mac to shut down that offense. So, for example, I don't think you would have seen a third – as much as it pains me to say this about the Chargers, who I now don't root for, I don't think – let's say they had Bosa and Mac in that situation. Or, hell, the Rams with Donald and Miller. There's no 13 seconds in that Buffalo Bills debacle.
No, you're right. You're right, because – look, the opportunity to pair two great quarterback killers on the same team is always something you're looking to do. So much like having a good wide receiver too, like you can't just have Davante Adams, right? We were talking about that last episode.
Right.
You got to need a complimentary guy. Same thing on defense. You could have a great edge rusher like Bosa, but we saw what happened last year. right? They get doubled. They get tripled. Same thing with Aaron Donald. You get doubled. You get tripled. You need someone to at least be
exactly.
someone to draw so that you get the one-on-ones, right? So I think with Mac, if Mac comes back healthy, if he's healthy.
Oh, and the foot has so many bones, you know. If it heals properly, he should be okay, but it's one of those injuries, you know.
But if he's healthy, the Chargers are a steal. Now, they got a steal if he's healthy. But on the other hand, like we said, he's 31. You know, his best years are behind him, statistically speaking. So we'll see how it works out, but it's an interesting trade, and I kind of liked it. Okay,
real
William.
Quick, on the Packers. On the Packers, this is an actual – they remember Aaron Rodgers says he didn't want to be in rebuild mode.
Correct.
So they said, well, we're not going to be in rebuild mode, and they're going to give him $200 million. But they have salary cap issues right now.
Yes.
Whereas the Bears have said, we're going to rebuild mode. We're going to eat the salary cap.
Right.
In a year from now, they're going to be okay. The Packers, they're going to be – that salary cap's going to hurt them. They have maybe 1 to 2 years to win it all.
Yeah.
And even then, it's not a complete team, as per what you said. So on the flip side, I think they're in salary cap hell already. And they are.
Let's
see those details, because remember, Rodgers tweeted that what was being reported wasn't exactly accurate. Yeah. But he did sign a contract.
Right. So we'll see what happens with that.
One more note on the Bears. The reason they don't have a first-round pick is because they traded up to get Justin Fields last year.
Yes, absolutely. They traded it to the Giants to get Fields. So I think they're all in a good place right now. Now, before we go, I have one question to pose to you. When we started the Mac segment, I said you felt like a jilted lover, or like a jilted girlfriend, because the Chargers left San Diego. So here's the question of the day, William. What's more dangerous? A jilted Latina girlfriend or a wild bobcat stuffed down your shorts? Which one's more dangerous, William?
A Latina. I have two Puerto Rican relatives. One just got out of jail for whacking a guy, and the other one was, don't piss her off, boy. She'll slice you.
I went out a couple of times back in my college days with a Latina girlfriend, a Puerto Rican girl, and I swear to you, one time she threatened to cut me for just glancing at another woman in a restaurant.
Yeah. For the Latinx people, calm down. Take a deep breath. We're joking.
No, she threatened to cut me. I'm not joking.
Hey,
all right.
They're fire, though.
Okay. So that's the podcast for this episode. I want to thank our guest, Tim McCullough, for coming on. He was great. We're going to try to get him on again in future episodes to talk some baseball. Thanks again to my co-host, William Del Pilar, fantasy pioneer and all-around good egg. And I'm Big John. Until next time, peace, America.
Peace out, fools.